okay? We adjudicate access authorizations in the Department of Energy using all the information available to us, and we use traditional methods to gather it. And you're looking up there at a national agency check, credit check, national agency check with inquiries, a single scope background investigation, which is the government standard. It's a 10-year background investigation performed by agents, either from the Federal Bureau of Investigation or from the Office of Personnel Management. I will tell you, as a practical matter, they're all contractors, because whether it's the VIX program in FBI or the OPM, USIS entity, it's pretty much privatized. But without an exception that I'm aware of, they're all retired FBI, Secret Service, they're professional federal investigators that have done this a long time. Those are the folks that ask your neighbors, you know, do you know Joe? Is he trustworthy? Does he have any bad habits? Yada yada. Interrogatories. We actually send out interrogatories to subjects when we get a question in reviewing all this information, and we want them to clear something up. Personnel security interviews are the next step, where we would bring somebody in when we have what we would term derogatory information, a felony conviction, eight DUIs, okay, something like that. And we do a personnel security interview. In a situation where you're talking possibly alcoholism or some sort of mental problem that would affect their, could affect their reliability, we send them to professionals, board certified professionals, and get an evaluation. Psychological evaluation. Polygraph examination is just one source of information. Okay, that's all put together, and professionals using our adjudicated guidelines, which are based on adjudication guidelines issued by the White House, are then used to make a decision whether to grant or to deny a security clearance. Now, I will tell you this, just to explain. This is really focused on the top-level clearances, what we call in the Energy Department acute clearance. Now, that's a clearance that clears a person to top-secret national security information and also to restricted data and formally restricted data under the Atomic Energy Act. And that's the difference between that and a Defense Department top-secret clearance. A top-secret NSI clearance just clears you for NSI. NSI is information classified under the President's authority as Commander-in-Chief pursuant to executive order. RD and FRD is information, because of its nature, that is, in the term it's used, is born classified. We're talking about nuclear material production, especially for material production like enriched uranium or nuclear weapons production, design and production. That is restricted data, formally restricted data. Next slide, please. Okay, I just wanted to cover briefly, and I changed the order, and this is where my staff was, because I thought it flowed better. This is where we use polygraph in the Department of Energy. We use it, of course, for counterintelligence screening. That is mandated by Congress. You know, you saw the number where they asked 1,001 people, do you think this was really necessary? And they said something like 782 said yes, and 150 said no. I'll tell you the truth, I would agree probably with those 150. Our problem right now is the Congress has mandated who gets polygraphed. I think there's a better way to do it. I would much rather have the Secretary of Energy mandate, based on the recommendations of his, you know, national security team, as to who gets polygraphed. But right now, counterintelligence screening is mandated by law for people who are, let's say, candidates for accessing the various programs within the department. We also use polygraphs in the department for expedited access to classified material. Stevie Grimes is my program manager for that program. It's called the Accelerated Access Authorization Program. We set this up, and that was Dave's entree into the Department of Energy, because we had a problem. We employ some of the most talented people around in our weapons labs, and in fact, through our whole laboratory complex. When those people need an acute clearance, and they're on salary, they're going to be sitting around for anywhere for, we actually do a lot better than the people across the river, please forgive me, Dr. Knight. But for about 2 months or so, maybe, if there's no problems, they're going to be sitting around. And we actually pay for expedited background investigations to get our people on board. Because it doesn't pay to take a high salary scientist or engineer and have him or her sitting somewhere in a booth, you know, for 3 months. So we set up the accelerated access authorization program. Our question was, how can we assure, you know, a high level of confidence in terms of putting these people to work, say, at Lawrence Livermore or Los Alamos, but do it before our traditional background investigation was completed. We got all the results from all that information gathering we do about a person. We set up a program that incorporated a counterintelligence polygraph. Okay, it incorporates a drug test, and it incorporates a psychological test. And that is a totally voluntary program. In other words, the person can say, I really want to get to work at Los Alamos. We have actually a few people saying that today. I shouldn't say. But the most of the people who were hired want to get in there and do the job. So we have a high number that will volunteer for this program. We have an extraordinary success rate. Okay, it's self-screening when you think about it. When a person will volunteer for a polygraph to get to work, you know, we've never had a problem. I think we've had on the order of maybe a one or two situation where after the full background investigations kind of came in, there was a problem that certainly wasn't the focus of the counterintelligence polygraph exam, but it did raise a problem. Am I right on that number?
One.
One. Out of how many?
Out of 3,000.
Out of 3,000. Okay. So, you know, I think I will tell you that I and my staff have a great deal of confidence in the accelerated access authorization program. And it's actually being looked at by other agencies as a model. Okay, then the other thing is exculpatory polygraphs. Now, we never ask a person to take these. Okay, I have to personally authorize it, and it's when that person is the subject of a concern. Okay, and they deny, you know, that they've ever been, you know, in San Diego or something on that date. And they ask us, can we take a polygraph? I'll take a polygraph. We say, okay. And it's done under the same quality control conditions that we apply anywhere. You know, and you get mixed results. I will say that. Some people, it's resolved. Some people, it isn't. I just wanted to make sure you had a clear picture of how we use this in the Department of Energy. The next slide, please. Now, what happens if information comes in that raises a doubt to the point that we feel we can't grant Joe Mahaley the clearance? We're an Administrative Procedure Act agency. We're covered by the APA. We have our administrative review process for access authorization eligibility determination set forth in the regulation, published in the code, federal regulations, and that sets forth a rigid due process, okay, that provides a right to a hearing. It's presided over by a hearing officer that does not work for me, which for DOE Office of Hearing and Appeals. A transcript provides for counsel on both sides. The department has a counsel. The subject can bring in a counsel. There's an appeal right. Under the regs, presently, there's a final decision by me, actually, the Director of Office of Security Affairs. After you've had the hearing, and an appeal right comes to me to take a look at those results and make a decision. And then there are reconsideration rights, okay, should I choose to revoke someone's clearance. Okay, fine. Now, I will tell you right now, we're working on regulations. We've been working on them for about a year and a half. That are going to incorporate a change that was actually ordered by the President in Executive Order 12968. I think I'm six or five.
You're right.
I'm right. All right. It was about 3 or 4 years ago, the President said, I would like to go to a system where we use a three-member panel to make this final decision. So when this reg gets issued, and I can't promise when it will be issued, literally was right on the cusp there when the order was issued to hold everything. I will be joined. I'll be the chairman of this panel, and then we'll have two other members to make a vote on it. Okay. I just wanted to emphasize that the way I read your charge, and the way I wrote your proposal, you're clearly an eminent group of scientists and serious engineers, and you're going to be looking at this as a scientific tool. You know, is it always right? I got to tell you, I don't believe it is always right. Just like I had a former resident, co-resident in North Arlington named Al Ames, okay? If you had gone out and, you know, all his neighbors and were asked by the agency, he was a good guy, you know, they probably would have said yes. Well, they were wrong. You know, you have to take all the information together you get from all the sources I'm talking about and make a good common sense decision under the legal guidance that's provided by the Atomic Energy Act, okay? I sort of agree with Dr. Sweats there that, you know, a no-call is, you know, it's of no help to me whatsoever. I mean, that won't help you in terms of accuracy, but as far as I'm concerned, it's just a wasted test, okay? I'm trying to gather information, enough information, relevant information about people to allow us to make that very critical decision, okay? And that's about all I wanted to say. The next one is, because I have to get out of here, I'm going to leave Steve on the hook here, and she can answer some questions. But I can take some questions now.
Can I begin? Because it's back to the question that was either, I thought was explicit, but I'm going to try to make it more so here.
Okay.
We're being asked to evaluate the scientific evidence, and we think we understand what that task is. I don't think we understand how we're going to do it yet. What we clearly have not been asked to do, and I don't see us yet even conceiving of doing, is evaluating the performance of the process you just described, which is a very complicated one involving all sorts of information gathering, and that's beyond the bench. But if we take the polygraph and ask about it as a screening tool in the context of such a process, it's really important to understand who knows what and how that is somehow part of the tool as it's used, and what the flow of information is in and out of that component. And I'm really struggling to understand that. Clearly, background information that comes to an examiner about Steven Feinberg and where he went to school, and that he's not an American originally, but now is. Now reveal it. Okay. That is, I am an American. that information is one kind of information, but if you sent an agent out into the field and he's gone to my colleagues and students and neighbors and began to ask questions, and there's some of that on the table, that begins to change it. And where are the boundaries of this? And are they hard and fast, or are they much more flexible? In which case, we have a harder job, I think, of assessing what it means to use this as a tool in that kind of screening context.
All I can tell you, sir, is that we will cooperate in any way possible in answering your question. I mean, this is an open conference. We do have adjudicated guidelines. I think they're the best in the government. I think my staff and I have 175 people who work for me who are federal contractors in addition to that. We worry about Washington headquarters security, obviously, but we also set policy for personal security for the rest of the department for the field activities. I have experts that talk to the panel and explain the adjudicated guidelines. I'm sure Caroline can put some of her experts at your disposal to brief you on the counterintelligence. Because there is a bit of a difference, the way Congress has set this up. You know, not everyone gets a polygraph for a Q clearance. If you have a Q clearance and you're going into a certain program, we do the counterintelligence screening polygraph. And then that result is just another piece of information. Then you take the all the other information available about Joe going into that program, and you evaluate that polygraph result and all that other information, and then the counterintelligence director makes a decision about access or no access to that certain program. Now, I will tell you, if the counterintelligence director denies that access, it raises a security question that comes back to my staff to resolve, obviously. It's in the nature of the follow-up. Our program has had so few problems. We've tested 1,600 people so far with how many? Two that had issues, maybe zero with issues or something? They may have been resolved. Right. Maybe one still. Okay, so they haven't been. I mean, it's a result that I'm extraordinarily happy with. In other words, 1,600 people at our labs have taken this thing, and you know, we haven't had any problems yet. Okay.
Sure.
My take on that question, maybe a little bit different, is you stressed, Steve, that we were supposed to make, are supposed to make a scientific evaluation. So that's a problem for us and for you. It was stated by Mr. Rensselaer, don't look at 1983 data. Of course, we don't want to do that. On the other hand, when you say, come down and see us and see how it's done today, we'd like to do that. But that's anecdotal as far as we're concerned. I mean, that's not yet science, just as we looked at how you're doing it today. So there is going to be a problem, and we need your help with what kind of data is current.
Yes, sir. And the reason that I said it that way is polygraph, as it's being done now in the DOE, was not done in 1983.
No, I appreciate the problem. There's no point in us.
And that's why we were so happy
that it was done in 1983 when it's totally irrelevant.
That's right.
On the other hand, how close can we get to what you're doing now with data?
Yeah.
You know, and some people are going to be concerned with data from peer-reviewed studies,
sure.
Journals. I take that point. So, we'd like your advice on that.
Well, that's why we're looking for a scientist to represent DOE at the Institute to do research, a non-polygraph examiner scientist.
To answer your question, sir, from my standpoint, your work is going to be most valuable to me if you're focusing on the DOE counterintelligence policy. And that's, I think, you know, if you focus on the way that Topeka Police Department did their screening polygraph right there, the results, you know, might be good, they might be bad. They're just not relevant to what we're doing. And I think that's what Dave is talking about. Now, I would never presume to tell the panel where to look or what data to study or anything like that. I will just tell you that I want to get the best possible information out of this procedure as possible. A false positive, it can happen. I haven't seen evidence of it yet. I was in general counsel. I looked at hundreds of personnel security cases. I can tell you, without violating the Privacy Act, I've only seen one case in the Energy Department that focused on polygraph and validity. And I will tell you also that was resolved in favor of the subject. Okay, and it was a classic battle of the experts. We do not follow the federal rules of evidence. We use them as a guideline, but you can, if both attorneys agree in the hearing, bring in this polygraph, make it an issue. And they did in that case. It's an old case. And it was an issue specific case. I should add that Dr. Ryan directed it was an interesting call. the, we're interested in the best possible data. I want the best information I can give, but I certainly, and this is just sort of reinforcing our concern, I think, about the literature review we saw at first. A lot of us believe in some of the literature out there isn't what you're doing, you know.
Given our mandate to assess validity, we have to appreciate there are going to be numbers.
Yes.
In that final report, we can't just make a clinical investigation.
Yes, sir. I understand.
Dave, during your talk, you sometimes referred to applying for clearance and sometimes to revoking clearance. Two questions for you. Is your process the same in the two?
Yes.
And is the due process the same?
Yes. Yeah, and whether it's a revocation of existing clearance or it's denying.
The APA
applies to both. Yes, absolutely. Now, there are situations, I will tell you, we have contractors. We have 14,000 feds and 100,000 plus contractors. A company may hire Joe Mahaley intending to put in work in a certain area. And when they get his application or in the hiring process, they may find something else where they will simply say, no further interest. Okay. If we never get to the point of adjudicating and that is a federal decision, okay, the APA isn't triggered. There's nothing that happened. Joe just didn't get that job, okay. And I have no figures on that, but I will tell you, I'm sure that would happen. You know, if somebody comes in and says, I killed three people, and they say, gosh, you can't work in the nuclear weapons plant in Pantex, you know, they, no further interest. The offer would be withdrawn.
Any other questions? I thank you, and we will ask extensively of staff, both for information and clarification and data, and we'll do the best we can to answer the question.
Thank you, sir. And we'll cooperate in any way we can.
Last presentation in the session that we scheduled is by Alan Zelikoff from the Center for National Security and Arms Control at Sandia National Lab.
Mr. Chairman, given the length of time that the committee has been sitting and also perhaps concerns about the temperature of the food, not to mention the temperature of the rhetoric, I'd be happy to... Let me talk a little bit about myself. I'm a senior scientist in the Center for National Security and Arms Control at Sandia National Labs. There are about 5,000 MS PhD staff members at Sandia. There are about 2,000 senior scientists. I've held that post for about a year. I'm a physician and physicist by training. And indeed, the way that I am looking at the issue is from the perspective of a physician. I'll come back to that in a moment. My charge is a rather difficult one. I have enough to have the mantle of representing the technical staff at Sandia, Los Alamos, and Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. That's humbling enough in and of itself. But also I have to tell you that within the laboratory itself, because of the mandate from the Congress, polygraphs are being implemented by the management at all three laboratories, although it is occurring with considerable resistance from the staff. And I think that there were a number of fallacies that have been uttered already in the session that, that we are now sitting in that I'm going to address as we go along. The polygraph is a diagnostic test. Now, it's certainly not a medical diagnostic test. In fact, the polygraph community has made every effort to keep the label medical diagnostic test away from the polygraph machine so as to avoid any of the regulatory requirements that are associated with medical diagnostic devices as are prescribed by the FDA. But whether or not it's a medical device, it is certainly a diagnostic test, and as such, it has certain characteristics. two in particular, which characterize all diagnostic tests, and those are the sensitivity and specificity of the test. The numbers that you have heard this morning are an amorphous fudge of words like accuracy, sensitivity, including the misuse of the word, as I'll illustrate in a moment, from multiple studies done under multiple conditions. This includes the guilty knowledge test as opposed to the counterintelligence test, sometimes known as the counterintelligence scope polygraph, or CSP for short. So I would urge you, when you're reviewing the data, to make very sure that you understand that you are looking at data that's applicable to the screening scenario, which is what we're talking about today, as well as the counterintelligence scope polygraph as opposed to the guilty knowledge test. I'm actually amazed at how well-bearded the panel already is in understanding all of that, so I'm going to exploit your knowledge by doing a few calculations in just a moment. But before I do, let me call to attention a couple of the fallacies that you've already heard this morning. First, you've heard that there have only been one or two people at Los Alamos, one or two people at Sandia, perhaps a small handful more at Lawrence Livermore, who have had problems with the counterintelligence screening test that has been administered as part of the DOE program over the past 6 months. It is common knowledge that one of the dirty little secrets about the implementation of the polygraph program at the DOE National Laboratories is that each laboratory director, or one of the senior vice presidents of the laboratory, has personally intervened to interview each and every polygrapher, and to say to those polygraphers that he, the vice president, or he, the director, will not be satisfied until and unless everyone passes the test. Looked at from the standpoint of the decision theorist, what this is doing is merely shifting down the receiver operator curve, and I'll illustrate that in a moment. But being under no illusion that the current implementation of polygraphs at the national laboratories is similar to the way polygraphs have been administered in other counterintelligence settings. Polygraphers, and make no mistake about it, are under pressure from the senior leadership at the laboratories to pass everyone. This, of course, reduces the sensitivity of the test and makes you wonder what the purpose of the test is in the first place. Now, with regard to the sensitivity and specificity of the test, let me try to illustrate in very concrete terms the way the national laboratory staff, the technical staff, is looking at this issue, because I feel it's my responsibility to communicate that to you so you can understand why this is a much more contentious tool in the setting of the national laboratory as opposed to perhaps in the Defense Department or in the intelligence agencies. Fun stuff to the board, Mr. Chairman.
Any point?
There's an old theorem by Thomas Bayes, it's called Bayes' theorem, that states the following, and I'll use the following notation. When I say the word B, I'm referring in this case to deception, and when I use the letter T, I'm referring to, in this case, the polygraph test. And Bayes' theorem states a simple and obvious fact from statistics 101, which is that the probability of deception being present in the presence of a positive test is equal to the sensitivity of the test, which is the probability that the test is positive if the deception is present, times the pretest probability of deception, in other words, the true positive rate, divided by that same number, plus the false positive rate, which is inherent in every test. And that can be expressed simply as the specificity of the test, or the false positive, I should say 1 minus the specificity or the false positive rate of the test, times the probability that deception is not present. Now let's use some of the numbers that we've heard today. Let's assume that the sensitivity of the test, which means how likely is it that the polygraph is going to pick up deception if true deception is occurring. I'm going to use the number 90%, which I frankly think is quite generous. That means that the probability of the test will be negative if deception is present, equal to 0.1. The much more difficult concept, and the one that is glossed over and used inaccurately by Mr. Ryan and others, is the sensitivity of the test. And that is the probability that the test will be negative if deception is present.
You said sensitivity, but you don't.
See, I do it myself. I mean specificity of the test. In this case, I'm going to assume that the specificity of the test is 0.8.
Excuse me. You mean the probability that the test is negative given that deception is absent, given that there's truth?
Yeah, I think you want to be more.
I'm sorry. Thank you. The probability that the test is positive.
The test is negative given that the person is telling the truth. T bar given T bar.
Yeah, okay. We can look at it that way as well. Okay, probably the test is negative if the deception is absent. We'll say it's 0.8. Okay? Which means that the probability that the test is negative if deception is present is 0.2, and that's the false positive rate. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. So this is the false positive rate. It's the probability the test is positive if deception is absent. All right. Well, let's put those numbers into Bayes' theorem, assuming that there is a pretest probability of 1 in 1,000 of deception taking place. I've asked many people to give me a pretest estimate of their guess of the number of spies, deceivers, saboteurs within the national laboratories, and the number that you get is 1 or 2 or 3 out of the national laboratory population. So I'm going to assume it's 10 times higher than that and say that the pretest probability of deception is 0.001. Okay. Well, let's run the numbers. If the test is positive, the positive predictive value, or the probability that the test is positive, the deception is present if the test is positive, is equal to 0.9 times 0.001 divided by the same number plus the false positive rate, which is 0.2, 1 minus the specificity, times the probability that the disease is absent, or that the deception is absent, in this case 0.999. This gives me approximately 0.0009 divided by the same number, plus, I'm going to call this close to 1, 0.2. That's approximately equal to 0.001 divided by 0.2, which is approximately 1 out of 200. Or something less than 0.5%. Okay? So what has the test given us? It's taken us from a pretest probability of one chance out of 1,000 to something closer to 1 chance out of 100. Okay? Not even 1 chance out of 100. A very small increment in the value of the test. If the pretest probability is even lower, as some would advocate that it is, this number is substantially worse. But more to the point, the number of false positives in my illustration here, 20%, compared to the number of true positives, something on the order of 0.5%, is 100 to 1. And so you have 100 positives for every true positive. The vast majority of them, of course, are false based on the characteristics of the test. To put it into a graph, if one plots the specificity of the test, which at maximum is 1, meaning no false positives, versus the sensitivity of the test, which also goes from 0 to 1, what you would like is a test that has characteristics like this. Meaning that the false positive rate is 0, or the specificity is 100%, across the entire range of sensitivity of the test. Now, most dike and flipping a coin looks like that. Most diagnostic tests in medicine look something like this, including screening tests. And if one increases the specificity enough, such that indeed you always have 100% specificity, meaning no positive rates, in the real world, the test looks like that. And it is indeed the area under the curve, the so-called receiver operator curve, which is the measure of the test. And this is the analysis that my colleagues at the National Laboratories use. And this is the reason that we've been suspicious or skeptical about the utility of the test for security purposes. The senior scientists at Sandia published a report in 1999 at the time of the DOE hearings, which we will make available to you electronically so you can distribute it easily. And the conclusions from the senior scientists were as follows. From a medical and scientific standpoint, it is not sufficient to measure well that which shouldn't be measured in the first place. Distinguish carefully between the ability to precisely measure a heart rate, a respiratory rate, or a galvanic skin response, and the value of that information for making a decision. The net yield is a few, perhaps one, two, or three, out of a few thousand National Laboratory employees, assuming the test is 100% negative, which is clearly not the case. And further, when you consider the use of a screening tool on a wide-based population, as is being advocated now, the temporary displacement from work, the interruption of that work, is substantial, even if the false positive rate is a few percent, because if you multiply a few percent by 20,000 National Laboratory employees, you end up with a large number of people. This is the kind of analysis that we would recommend that the panel look at. So to summarize, the question is not whether you can accurately measure blood pressure, pulse, galvanic skin response, and respiratory rate. Rather, the question is, over a reasonable range of assumptions about sensitivity and specificity of this test, and over a reasonable range of assumptions, what the likelihood of deception is in any given employee, in other words, doing a sensitivity analysis, does the benefit of the test justify its cost in real terms, that is the cost of the program itself, the cost to employee morale, which includes the morale of potential recruitees into the laboratory, and then finally, the cost to individual careers when clearances are suspended. One last point. You heard today from several people that polygraphy is merely one tool. And I suppose that you're supposed to take some sort of consolation from that. Well, if a tool is used correctly, you should take consolation from that. But if a tool is used all of the time, then it is not merely one tool, but it is one tool that is being used for all purposes. And that's as silly in medicine as doing a cardiac stress test on everybody. It was mentioned by Mr. Ryan that cardiac stress tests have a certain level of sensitivity and specificity, and if you come up with a positive, then you want to move to a test that has the next higher level of sensitivity. So that's exactly incorrect. What you want to do is move to a test that has the next higher level of specificity to avoid the false positives. And indeed, in system studies that look at the use of cardiac stress tests in a large population, what you find is the net outcome of screening everybody with a test that has characteristics very similar to the sensitivity and specificity that I just mentioned here, results in a net outcome that is much worse than if you screen nobody at all. And the reason for that is that it leads to a cascade of other diagnostic tests, each of which has its own risks, due to ever-increasing intrusion and ever-increasing possibility, therefore, of hurting somebody. So, in summary, this is the approach the National Laboratory employees have used. We would urge you to do the same kind of analysis by looking at the range of sensitivity and efficacy that's been ascribed to the test, and to then balance that off against the costs of the program itself and the human costs that are associated with the temporary displacement from work that almost inevitably occurs if people fail the college access. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Give me your numbers and some of the statements other people have made. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say that the other investigation could affect the higher probability, so that if we find out, for example, the candidate has very high debt, has other difficulties in one's life, in effect that the base rate of the prior probability is sensitive to that, to the point 001 might be an overstatement there as well, if in fact the test is being used with other criteria.
I agree with you completely. However, the test is being used as a broad-based screening tool. If you use the test based on other information, then the test, then this number changes, and the positive predictive value of the test is very, very different.
But potentially you could blind the user of the screening tool, have it go up the ladder, and then use it again later with a new prior probability.
No, you can't use the same test twice, because all the statistical analysis is based on the independence of the test that you're applying. If you apply the same test twice, then you're not using an independent test. I would agree with your statement that if you use the polygraph screening test results only after you had other information and you blinded the decision maker who's determining or the panel is determining who's going to get a security clearance or who's going to lose their security clearance, then you would be correct. But if that's the case, why screen hundreds of people, perhaps even thousands of people, when you only need the test in a small select number of people? And that is the difference between the effectiveness of the polygraph and the guilty knowledge test, where you driven this number up because, indeed, of other investigatory tools, so-called reasonable suspicion, if you will, in the law. That is the precise difference. So I would agree with you if and only if the results were completely barred were completely put aside, unless and until a panel requested those results based on other information that raised this number. But if that's the case, you should only polygraph people at the time that you need the information,
because then you're just wasting money. Kathy, and then
Joe. Thanks for your presentation. I think that it is very useful for the panel to think in decision theoretic terms the way you've laid it out, and I think that that's probably something that we'll come back to, especially for people on the panel who aren't trained in decision theory. But I'd like to also raise the issue then, if you're going to think this way about the polygraph, maybe you should also think this way about the background investigation, because everybody that gets a Q clearance has to go through a background investigation. Is there any data on the sensitivity and specificity of the background investigation process?
I'm not aware of any.
And it's obviously quite costly. I mean, they have to send somebody out to go and interview my neighbors, and they have to send somebody to and go and interview my colleagues and coworkers, and ask them questions and go, you know, if I had some issue, like I once was, I had some DUIs, they're going to go investigate the police, or if I was ever, they're going to go investigate my mental health professional, visited the mental health professional, go talk to that person, et cetera. And that's very expensive.
Correct.
And it also is sometimes regarded by people as intrusive. There are people who avoid jobs requiring security clearances because they don't want that kind of intrusion. Do you think there would be less resistance to this if the polygraph were part of that routine background investigation as opposed to something that's coming down on people newly?
No.
Because you're worrying about people losing their clearances as opposed to just not being hired or not being given the clearance in the first place.
Right. But among technical staff, I think that the resistance to the polygraph would be the same, strictly because of this analysis.
Why is there a greater resistance to polygraph than to a background investigation?
Right. Okay. Let me try to come at your question two ways. First is that there is a belief that a human in the loop continuously evaluating information that may come in background investigation is somehow less, there's belief they're somehow less likely to generate a false positive than a single diagnostic test like this, because it indeed involves the metrical thinking that goes on in the human cortex. And I can't get any more specific in answering your question than that, other than to additionally say that there is widespread recognition among the members of the technical staff that there should be some deterrence against just anybody getting a security clearance. To put it another way, the members of the technical staff of the three defense laboratories welcome any kind of reasonable security investigation that will deter people from applying for security clearance. All right? And there's a high deterrence value that is placed, either because it's a belief or because there's data out there, I don't have any data, but certainly because of the belief, that the background investigation deters potential saboteurs, spies, espionage.
And the polygraph wouldn't.
Correct. Simply because the polygraph itself is a tool that relies on the ability of the polygrapher to convince the subject that the machine is actually able to detect one way or another some level of deception.
Let me just give you a little bit of anecdotal evidence. I know somebody personally who has said to me, I used to smoke pot when I was in college, but I wouldn't now because I have to take a polygraph.
Right. I understand that.
Sounds like deterrence to me.
Sure. In your end of one, you're correct. As time has gone on in the education process of members of the technical staff at the lab, the ruse that constitutes polygraphy, which is when the polygrapher tries to convince the subject that the machine has some ability to discriminate deception from non-deception, that has been recognized as a ruse, and people are much less deterred by the polygraph than they are by the background investigation, which they believe is far more likely to turn up incriminating evidence. It's a belief.
Do we have data on that question?
I'm not aware of any. Is anybody else
going to get it? So this is anecdotal.
I'm just telling you, I characterized it by a belief.
Okay. Good. As long as we understand it.
Yeah.
John?
Can I see your graph?
Sure.
I just know that what's the bottom sweeping curve?
Oh. What I was trying to illustrate here is that is the point that I made when I started off my talk, which is that the directors at the laboratories have told the polygraphers who are actually conducting investigations at the Department of Energy laboratory that they will pass everybody. So the test has...
Well, I'd like the chance to talk with you later about that. I don't think the performance curve can go below that diagonal. There may be a way to make your point. I think your point is that you move down the curve, or up the curve in this case, to a greater specificity when you set a strict criterion. And you don't want, when you want everybody to pass, you don't want anybody to fail. But you'll be up in the right rather than...